Open Source relies on listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Digital distemper has been the trend through 2018. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg looked like presidential timber early last year at age 33, connecting the world, giving everyone a voice, and dropping in on every state in the union. Today, he looks like a piñata in our Congress, in Britain's Parliament, too. But it's not all about poor Zuck or even Facebook's cutthroat business practices or the major mischief of Russian trolls hacking our presidential politics online. Maybe it's the inhuman speed of the tech, the sudden size of five digital monsters, Fanga, Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, Amazon. Maybe it's the infiltration of language, psychology, work, family, everything, the intrusiveness of it all. People say they don't use apps now as much as apps use them. Turn off a new car engine and the screen says, goodbye. Hello? On Boston Common this week, we were asking people how phones make them feel.
I definitely feel better when I'm off of social media and kind of leave my phone and my computer aside.
I'm 21, so I can't much imagine life without it, but there is life beyond it, and sometimes people tend to forget that.
It's a blessing and a curse sometimes, technology. It's a blessing because now you get to be in touch with people that you wouldn't be in touch with normally, and but then also, you know, people are stuck to their phones these days. So it's a curse, too.
I feel like some days I love it and some days I hate it. And I spend a lot of time just, like, scrolling through and it never ends. And then all of a sudden 20 minutes have gone by and can't get those back.
Actually, it's very helpful in my job, but I don't do Facebook, so.
Why not?
I like to be a ghost. I don't want people to find me.
The Pokemon game out here, you've got 150 people in the garden, one of the most beautiful spots there is, all staring at their phones.
Sometimes it makes me feel good. Other times, you get kind of self-conscious. Like, you want to look like the other people that you see. Like, more skinny, more fit.
Everybody paints this picture-perfect world that they live in. If it can be a little bit disheartening, if that's all you're focusing on, I just think you can project yourself onto other people's life. It's not real.
We have children, so certainly we're concerned about these things because we know there is a psychological void for them. Being isolated, not having that physical contact and eye contact, hearing someone's laugh, things like this.
I stay well away from social media if I can at all avoid it, but phone home, see the kids, you know, FaceTime, all of that type of stuff. Probably use it too much, but you know, walking around here, it's better to keep it in your pocket and actually look at what's around you.
Fred Turner is the great eavesdropper on public culture and conversation from Stanford University, and he strikes our keynote this hour. We're attempting, Fred, at an inventory of effects in the digital world. A lot of it comes from the New Year's piece in Harper's Magazine. The lead piece is by Fred himself, called Machine Politics, the Rise of the Internet, and a New Age of Authoritarianism. It's a heavy word, Fred, if that's where we're going. How do you get there? How do we get there?
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, it's a long and sort of sad story. You know, a lot of the ways that we built a kind of decentralized communication system were created originally in the 40s and 50s, and particularly in the late 40s with the rise of computation, to prevent the rise of fascism. You know, we thought fascism was a centralized phenomenon. You know, you give a dictator a mass medium and people sort of fall into line and erase themselves. And the best way to prevent the rise of fascism, so the thinking went at the time, was to design systems that were decentralized, on which people would have individualized voices, they would be able to express themselves, speak their individual truths. And that dream of a kind of decentralized public sphere of individuals all expressing themselves came straight down to us through the 1960s, through the protests of the 1960s, through the neoliberal policies of the 1980s and 90s, and the mass media deregulation.
Yeah, it was my sense of the blog world that bloomed when? In the new century.
But, blog world begins in the aughts. Yeah, absolutely. But it begins in sync with this idea of a kind of expressive democracy that has been going on for decades by the time the bloggers come on the scene. You know, the internet looked originally like it was going to be sort of the perfect medium to bring this social vision into being. Well, it turns out that, as Robert Frost used to say, you know, good fences make good neighbors. And if you connect the world and you give everyone a voice, you open the door to a kind of cacophony that's very dangerous. And even more important for folks on the right, you give folks on the right a new toolkit, a way to connect with one another, to present the illusion that they are, in fact, a powerful united force, and to speak in a kind of authentic, personalized idiom in which someone like Richard Spencer, a white nationalist, can pretend to be the equivalent of someone speaking at home, describing his sort of ordinary life among his friends, and can thereby naturalize white nationalism as if it were just something that, you know, smart young things talked about at dinner.
Fred Turner, let me say, I lived that techno-optimism of 2002, 2003, 2004, blog world became podcast world. What went wrong? And are you sure it has gone wrong?
Well, I think there's a couple things that went wrong. The first thing that went wrong, I think, was actually advertising. You know, the internet early on was funded by sort of a variety of sources. A lot of it was state-sponsored. But when advertising kicks in a big way and it becomes possible to monetize fractions of attention and fractions of individual expression, boy, that really changes things. You know, Facebook goes from being a place for college students to get to know one another to being a global kind of mine, a mine in which our social world can be turned into ore to be mined and monetized. So I think advertising is a big part of it. But I also think underneath that is the fantasy that a society of expressive individuals is sufficient to make a democracy. It just isn't. We need the kinds of institutions we used to poo-poo.
You know, the commercialism of the web exactly repeated the commercialism of broadcasting in the 20s and 30s. Brits went to the BBC, we went to CBS, and that became the model of the commercial institutions. What was the difference, the lost opportunity of the web, Fred?
I think the lost opportunity, and it may not be entirely lost, it may yet live in pockets, you know, was the opportunity to build collaborative, conversational coalitions among folks who might not otherwise be able to meet in person and who can do things that might amplify things that they care about in the world. Now, you and I might care about a certain kind of thing, and unfortunately the same thing that lets us care about those things and express them also empowers white nationalists to do a very different kind of thing. It's the same kind of structure. So I think that's important. But I also think that your insight that this the internet that we have today, the highly commercialized internet, is an extension of a commercialized media system that's 100 years old is exactly right. The internet is not so far from television these days, and that's a very sad thing.
And yet, this was different. It didn't just go commercial. In the case of Facebook, it scooped up and killed basically the whole blog history of individual people rattling on individually, and it put it all in one unimaginably big flood of money to one corporation. But was it money that ruined it? And then I want to ask, maybe leap over that to Donald J. Trump. When you say it becomes the an authoritarian voice and you link it to Trump, I'm still trying to figure out what the link of Trump is. So, and it's not just Twitter. I mean, it's Twitter, just not his tweeting on Twitter.
Right. So let me take the two questions a little bit separately. I think that, you know, Zuckerberg's ability to suck up the social world and put it all on Facebook is not all that different than what we saw in the mid-20th century with television, when we had three dominant networks that sucked up a great deal of public life and did, in fact, place it on the television screen for profit. So I do think we've got an acceleration and an amplification on Facebook of a process that starts much earlier. The Donald Trump authoritarian piece is counterintuitive and to me personally quite painful. When we go back to the 1940s, fascists were to be recognized by their self erasure. They were thought to have taken their emotions and turned them over to a leader, and the leader, a Hitler or a Mussolini, would be expressive on behalf of his people, and the people themselves would be standing in sort of automaton like rows of robot like people, you know, prepared to march on behalf of the single will of the leader. Only the leader got to express their will. Only the leader got to express their emotion. In our own time, thanks in part to the politics of identity and to a long history of kind of the individualization and personalization of American public life, we've created a world in which everyone has access to emotion, and including those on the right. And ironically, the same techniques that we used to kind of express our authentic selves in the public sphere, complaining about our lived experience, talking about our ethnicity, talking about our gender, are things that Donald Trump now uses from the right to claim his authority over the rest of us. And I say it's authoritarian not only because he uses the sort of expression of emotion in a way that claims power, but because he uses it to deny those who are different from himself power. That's the authoritarian move. That's the Hitler move. That's the Mussolini move. My body, my expressive experience, my raced experience, my gendered experience is the ideal. I speak for the whole. My body, my emotions, I represent the nation. And you can see Trump doing that for his base in very much the way that you saw Mussolini or Hitler do it for theirs.
Might it have been a liberal or a leftist capture?
I think so. You know, I think this is an interesting problem. I actually think that we've individualized authoritarianism across the board, left and right. And folks who remember the middle of the 20th century remember that the Nazis were hardly the only authoritarians. Stalin's Russia was every bit as bad. And, you know, you can have authoritarian regimes on left and right. And I do think the individualism that we see Donald Trump invoking is available to those on the left likewise.
Fred, there's a key line in your Harper's piece, and I'm still not sure exactly what you mean. You say Trump has mastered the politics of authenticity for a new media age. Parse that.
Sure. So back in 1968, at the Democratic National Convention, students protested the war in Vietnam, and they did it by putting their bodies on the line and expressing their own individual lived fears, their own lived experience. And they talked about it at the time as being a politics of authenticity. We are going to be our authentic selves. We're going to be authentic men, authentic women, authentic to our experience, and we're going to hold that up against the alienated world of kind of mainstream America. Donald Trump has taken his own ability to take his own experience, his own lived experience, and hold it up against what he calls the deep state in a way that they would have done themselves, but now he's doing it from the right.
Stand by, Fred Turner. Coming up, Moira Weigel, scholar of literature, anthropologist of dating, is going to track the digitization of us, plus kids on their own videos, coming up on Open Source. Annals of the Digital Age. Moira Weigel co-edits the quarterly magazine called Logic, about technology. We met you, Moira, around your first book, Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating, 2 years ago, I think, or forever, in the history of digital effects. What's new?
A lot's new. Thanks for having me on, Fred. Chris, it's always good to be back here. So much has changed in 2 years. It does feel almost like a different world. You know, when we were first talking about that book back in 2016, the Trump election was just on the horizon. I think a lot of what might seem new does seem like continuations of the same things we were talking about then. You know, the enclosure, the ways in which social media and apps have found ways to turn, as Fred was saying, all these aspects of social life and everyday life into minds of profit, of attention profit. I think probably what feels distinctly new is all the political stuff happening more than the trends in dating.
Maybe it's because I have grandchildren entering the cell phone age of life. I had been looking for instances of or descriptions of digital age childhood, and then there was Bo Burnham's movie last summer, Eighth Grade, about her a girl and her cell phone in middle school. Bo Burnham said later that the whole culture is going through an eighth grade moment, meaning lumpy and bumpy. Right out of school himself, Bo Burnham had been doing stand-up comedy and YouTube videos about digitized adolescent like this.
Because YouTube is a place for people to share their ideas. If by people you mean 13-year-old girls, and by ideas you mean how they love the Jonas Brothers. I'm just kidding, but let's be honest, that's a hefty majority. And if you don't believe me, well, then you must be a noob. So welcome to YouTube. You don't know what you're missing. Just try.
We spent an afternoon looking at some of those YouTube videos or vlogs that teenage girls share with one another in a vast network like this.
Hey guys, what is up? Welcome back to my channel. You guys started asking me like, hey Bailey, like, can you do a back to school clothing haul? And I was like, yeah, once I go shopping.
Hi, my name is Meadow. Today I'm gonna show you how to be popular at school. Okay, first thing first is that you are going to have like smooth lips, okay? So first you're gonna need a toothbrush.
Hey guys, it's Mia. Before we get started, I would like to say thank you, Thanks Between, for sponsoring this video. Thanks Between is for young people with periods.
I'm going into fifth grade, if you didn't know, and I usually don't put on makeup for school, but some people want to, and that is totally okay. And you be you, you can put as much as little as you want.
Oh, also I had a panic attack. That was really fun. I was bawling my eyes out. And then I was like really happy after, so.
This girl named Sarah, she let out a secret of mine. And she wasn't supposed to. And she just told people about it.
And I like never went to school because it got to the point where like it was actually like scary to go to school, and I like didn't feel like going, kind of. Not like, it's not that I didn't feel like going, it's more of like I just didn't feel comfortable going.
So it was like, for me, I'd rather not sleep and get a video up, because getting that video up is the only thing that gives me an ounce of happiness, while being at school literally made me want to die.
Hey guys, what do we make of these new media stars? First, Moira, and then Fred Turner, please. Do you know some of these kids, Moira, get 2 million plays of each one of these pieces? And some of them have commercial sponsors already. What were you hearing?
I'm glad to hear someone's getting paid on the platforms. look, I think it's interesting. I hear a lot in those videos. In the first sort of parody ditty, you know, about girls who like Jonas Brothers, you know, who don't have ideas, that just like Jonas Brothers on YouTube, I have to say I'm also hearing a lot of misogyny around female expressive culture. I think that it's complicated. I think that to the extent that private life and social life are increasingly commercialized by these new digital platforms and technologies, it's often easy, and this isn't the first time in the history of capitalism this has been the case, but it's often easy to point to female users of the technology or certain kinds of expression on the platform and treat them as trivial, as evidence of inauthenticity, certain kinds of performance. And I think that, to be honest, I was sort of troubled by that Jonas Brothers line, saying it's the Jonas Brothers and not ideas, because it seems to be engaging yet again in this topos that women are frivolous, that that the matters they're interested in are not serious or worthy
of
consideration.
In that band of their own videos, I didn't hear one inauthentic moment. You could say constructed, or maybe unwise, or maybe immature, but they're all amazingly themselves, I would have said. Fred, what's your take?
They're very much themselves, but they're very much themselves in an idiom that's been shaped by the commercial environment in which they live. You know, it's so interesting. As the young girl was talking about how you need to have smooth lips for school, I kept thinking back to the 1920s cigarette campaign, when women were thought to free themselves, thanks to the work of an ad team, by smoking cigarettes. You know, women were suddenly free to smoke and free to injure themselves. And I do very much take Moira's point that there's a misogynistic element here in the song, and in some of the depiction. But at the same time, I think we have to be careful not to imagine that the expressive authenticity of these girls is necessarily empowering. It's like a lot of commercial speech of earlier eras. It's ambiguous. It's ambivalent. On the one hand, it may be somewhat empowering. It brings the truth of their experience into some kind of light. At the same time, it helps integrate them and anyone who watches them into a world in which consumption is seen as the primary mechanism of self-expression.
Moira.
Yeah, no, I certainly wouldn't dispute any of that. I don't know. I think all expression is constructed by certain kinds of systems of signification,
of course,
and certain kinds of media technologies.
Are you objecting to girls addressing each other as, hey guys?
I usually say folks. I'm a good leftist, so I say folks. I try to avoid the gendered collective. But what do you?
It's just internalizing that we're all boys or something.
Yeah, I think, again, I usually try to say folks or people. I wouldn't get mad at a girl for saying, hey, guys. But I think I take Fred's point. I think that we hear both. We hear these young women constructing themselves, self-fashioning in an idiom that comes to them through this digitally mediated culture, doing it to get clicks and likes on YouTube, if not a commercial sponsorship. But we also do hear them sharing real difficult experiences of being a teenager, you know, panic attacks, not wanting to go to school, that kind of anxiety that I imagine many of us, if not all of us, have experienced in one form or another. So I think that it is an ambivalent phenomenon, and it's important not to be too quick to trivialize and dismiss young women online.
I didn't hear the trivialization. I thought there's an incredible empowerment, maybe prematurely, but we don't have to argue that point. Fred, you make categories in the incredible range of effects of the digital transition, institutional, cultural, and psychological. Do you want to give us a quick run past those divisions?
Sure, I can say a little bit about each of them. You know, I think if you look at the long history of digitization, which is about 60 years now, since about 1948, you see institutions simultaneously able to sort of centralize power and to decentralize their activities. Hmm. So you see something like, you know, Uber, where you have a central, almost like the head of an octopus running the company, and you have many, many sort of individualized tentacles running out in the world, running companies. And the sort of twinned pressures to individualize and pressures to centralize, and that's the institutional space. The psychological space, I think we heard really well in the videos that we just listened to from YouTube, and it's a space where people are, as Moira said, self-fashioning, but in terms that are not set for them. Locally, they're set for them by a much larger commercial sphere. So they're making themselves, but they're making themselves in terms that were not their own necessarily until they make them somewhat their own. In the cultural space, I think we encounter a kind of collision of these two phenomena, the institutional and the psychological. You know, we inhabit a world where we're sort of working through our desires and working through the ways that we make a living, and working through our feelings of independence or not independence in a setting where the technologies we're using to do that are connected to and empowering institutions that are often opaque to us. You know, sometimes I think that my cell phone is a mirror or a window, but it's something that every time I pick it up connects me back to a whole series of companies whose existence I may know only as a screenshot or an app, if I know it at all. And, you know, we've seen recently that Zuckerberg was retailing or trying to retail data to other people who are going to advertise on his system. My point here is that as digitization changes these three aspects of our experience, institution, culture, and psychology, it does it in concert with an already existing commercial and political infrastructure. And that infrastructure and the people who run it are trying to take advantage of the emerging systems in ways that, I would say on the whole, don't necessarily improve our lives.
Mara, were you connected to big puzzles in my head? The digital connection with identity politics, that's a large one, but also the emergency illness of the emergency condition of the humanities broadly.
Oh, wow, that's
two
a
big,
big
subject.
One. Maybe I'll start with identity politics. I think that it's really interesting. I've sometimes thought that social media are, in a sense, like vast engines for kind of revealing structure, right? I mean, the way that a platform like Facebook works, or what it works for, is to analyze all these things we do and break us up according to different kinds of markers of identity that might make us more or less likely to buy boots or a ski vacation or adopt a dog or whatever it's showing us an ad for. And to this extent that what this is doing is making us recognize aspects of our persons and our practices or our behaviors that are shared with other people, you know, the parts that are sort of more structural than personal. There's a way in which, you know, it's constructing new kinds of identity categories all the time. Of course, we're also seeing the reemergence of very old kinds of identity, self-understanding, and bigotry in these spaces, which, like the YouTube algorithms that recommend people move to white nationalist videos are being prodded along by opaque digital mechanisms in all kinds of ways. So I think, yeah, I think they're shaping in some ways new forms of identity politics and in some ways just amplifying old ones.
Fred, review the bidding about psychology. I mean, is it too soon to say that digital speed, just for that feature of it, is bad for conversation, bad for eye contact, maybe even bad for family life, but certainly for reading and for writing?
I'm not yet sure. I'm aware that we need to actually get a little academic for just a sec.
Go for it.
You know, I was raised in a tradition of psychology that is essentially Freudian. It says that we tell each other and tell ourselves stories about our experience, and those stories in turn shape what we experience. I think that a lot of the digital world is operating in an entirely different domain, and psychologists here at Stanford talk about, you know, behavioral psychology and Daniel Kahneman's work especially. You know, the timing that these systems are using is so fast, so rapid. The systems that they're appealing to are not Freudian systems of conscious and unconscious. They're almost embodied systems of stimulation, of excitement or non-excitement. And so what I think is going on is that we're entering a space in which these new technologies and the people who run them are working to have a kind of psychological effect on us that we don't even really have a language for, because it's a psychological effect that's taking place in our bodies, not our minds. And that urge that you have to pick up your phone, to check your phone, right, to get that little hit, that's an urge that comes from the same systems, the same bodily systems that render you prone to addiction, to caffeine addiction, to heroin addiction. And that's what scares me, that we're entering a space where this other psychological system is invoked, and that makes it very hard to reflect, to read, to slow down. If you're addicted to stimulation, if you want to play pinball all the time, it's very hard to settle down and read a novel.
Maura, are you worried about overexcitement?
Yeah, I think I'd agree. I think I would share the concerns that Fred was just expressing. I do think there are ways in which these devices are changing our attention spans, you know, changing our practices of reading and engaging with the kinds of materials, to get back to your earlier question, that one wants to teach or read or engage with in the humanities. So I do think I share those concerns.
And I worry also about just reflection, the benefits, the happiness of loneliness, of the dark night. The dark night of the soul, in truth, I keep going back to Sven Burkitt's, a writer who wrote an interesting book, Gutenberg Elegies. It's like 15 or 20 years ago. But it was all about a speed, a rush of information, of excitement, of stimulation, of visuals that would make kind of the private man, the joys of solitude, impossible.
Chris, can I offer a defense of speed?
Please.
So I know Sven's book.
How fast can
well,
you do it?
Yeah, well, pretty quick, I think. It's so interesting to hear you talk. It's exactly the same kinds of things that people said about the train in the 19th century. You know, this is what Thoreau was so upset about when he sat by Walden Pond and the train came through and whistled and roared and seemed to bring the whole spirit of modernity with it.
Right.
And, you know, in the wake of Thoreau's concerns, you know, we did see things speed up in ways that we might be bothered by, but we also saw the rise of cosmopolitanism. We saw people leave their small towns and move to cities and become new kinds of people. And, you know, as nervous as I am about where the Internet is taking us, I remain also somewhat hopeful that somehow the speed that we fear now might be a little bit like that 19th century train, taking us toward a new and more cosmopolitan kind of world. I hear a little bit of that in Moira's comment also about the ways that we manage our identities online. I wonder if there's not a new kind of cosmopolitanism that's possible, and that we might be able ultimately even to build a humanities that approaches that kind of question.
We will ask her. But first, I just got to love your mention of Thoreau. He thought he could walk to Fitchburg or to Boston from Concord faster than he could by waiting for the train. Moira, you're a journalist in this field. Where do you want to point our curiosity, our noticing, our attention?
I want to reiterate what Fred said. I always think of the German sociologist Wolfgang Schievelbusch, who has this amazing book about the history of the railways, and it's full of these 19th century anecdotes about people not only being anxious about the effects the train will have on society, but really expressing disorientation about, like, the ways perception is changing, about the sense that the ocean has become a lake, that, you know, things are moving too fast. So anxiety about, like, the physical dangers brought by the railroad, but also about the ways it's changing minds and brains, as we talk about now. So I think this is when folks express a kind of nostalgia for a time before technology, I always ask, you know, well, when do you want to go back to? I think humans are defined by our relationships to technology. We're animals that make things. And so that what Fred was just saying really resonates for me. So as much as I think there's a lot to worry about in the how the platforms are owned and organized and many of the scandals and revelations that you were alluding to earlier on the show, I think it's important to keep in mind that there's no solution, that abandoning technology is not and will never be a solution. It has to be about the reorganization of technology.
Isn't it possible, Fred, that Tony Judt had it right? He thought the train had it about right, maybe for all time. It was a good speed, 100
maybe
he miles
grew
an hour,
up on trains.
And that the train itself was the perfect place to be alone together. And together alone, a lot of independent people traveling in one direction.
Maybe, but let me make a plug for the airplane. As cramped as an airplane is, everything that you just said about Tony Judt's train is how I feel when I'm up in the air.
It depends on where you're going.
Depends
and,
you're
and when you have to get
to.
There, when you have to be back.
And who you're sitting next to. Good point.
That's true.
As a woman who tries to read books on planes, I'll say that.
We're talking effects of the digital age, counting them one by one, with Fred Turner. Coming up, Maura Weigel's co-editor at Logic Magazine, who happens to be her husband, Ben Tarnoff. His question might be, which of the digital machines would you smash if you could? This is Open Source. Luddites generally get a bad press for the organized effort among English workers 2 centuries ago to smash the machines of the young Industrial Revolution. What if they were half right, or what might the moral be for the digital revolution? Ben Tarnoff grew up Californian. He writes history and a column for The Guardian. Ben, remind us of the Luddites, 1810 or so.
Yeah, well, first, thanks for having me, Chris.
Always a pleasure.
So the Luddites were a group of textile workers in England in the early 19th century who smashed machines. And they didn't smash machines because they objected to machines in the abstract. They smashed them because the machines that were being introduced by the owners of the mills where they worked were decimating their livelihoods, were decimating their communities. Mm. They were allowing the owners of these mills to pay them less, to speed up the work, to deny them control over the labor process, deny them autonomy, deny them the capacity to reproduce themselves. Mm. So they organized a labor action, essentially, and smashed a number of machines and mills throughout England. And I think that it provides us with a useful reference point. I think we now think of the Luddites kind of broadly as anti-technology, but I think it's more constructive of us to see them as making it a very kind of, frankly, sensible, totally rational, targeted intervention to eliminate certain technologies that were having damaging effects on their lives.
Yeah, they're pictured as mindless, but in fact, as you've told me, they were very shrewd observers of exactly what was going on. They were noticing what was in front of their face. What would they see today?
Well, it's a complicated question. I mean, Fred and Maura were talking about the ambivalent situation we find ourselves in, I think, which is always the situation we find ourselves in with technology, where on the one hand, there are emancipatory possibilities. There are also fairly repressive possibilities, and we probably see the latter more predominant these days. But I think what the Luddites might tell us, or what they at least give us the possibility of, is that certain machines need to be smashed. Not all machines can be reconfigured. And I think that's really important, particularly now when we are having this broader political discussion about, well, what do we do with the platforms? What do we do with Facebook? What do we do with AI, the whole question of AI governance? And I think it's very important as we approach that conversation to have the off-ramp, to have the exit option, to say there might be certain technologies, facial recognition comes to mind, that maybe we shouldn't build at all. maybe the damaging effects of those on communities, in particular communities of color, on which these technologies will be used by the police, mm-hmm. that the social costs of these technologies are simply too great, and we won't proceed with them any further. I think that could give us the Luddite option, so to speak.
Who is this revolution serving, would you say, broadly, other than, well, all sorts of new companies and capitalist investors? But what's the big drive behind it?
Well, technology throughout the history of capitalism, you know, is used generally in order to expand control over the labor process, to discipline workers, to displace certain workers, to de-skill certain jobs. So I think we're seeing another iteration of that now. Mm. I mean, we've been talking a lot about technologies like Facebook and social media, and those are certainly important. But we're also seeing the proliferation of technologies in the workplace, technologies that are surveilling workers, disciplining workers, a camera that monitors you while you work and uses machine learning to try to determine whether you're focused, whether you're happy, whether you're content in your job. Again, these are very old techniques. We've got, of course, Frederick Winslow Taylor back in the late 19th, early 20th centuries developing his scientific management theory on the basis of kind of methodical, even kind of obsessive surveillance of the workplace. So this method is very old, and I think we have to see it within this broader frame of how capitalism develops and implements technology.
I want your thought. Sure, go ahead, Fred.
Can I just jump in on what Ben was saying? Because I think he's right on point. I just want to extend it and say that I would argue that one of the other new features of the present is that the machines of our time are being used to transform former places that were formerly outside the workplace into workplaces. So my conversations with my family, to the extent that I have them on Facebook, generate value for Facebook. I'm actually laboring for Facebook. And I think that's also part of the larger legacy of capitalism, that it does work to expand and to turn whatever ore it can into something mineable and monetizable.
Yeah, and this was absolutely the theme of my book about dating and sort of what I was trying to get at with talking about. I think I used the metaphor of enclosure earlier. What we see with these platforms is that they're not only making the workplace, which frankly now is often dispersed and takes place in a cafe or in your car wherever you're driving, not only is the workplace a site of labor and profit accumulation, but basically every aspect and interaction in our everyday lives is or can potentially be made into one as well.
All of you, speak to the anxiety of 20-somethings, 30-somethings out there who feel that there's a direct threat here to not only their livelihood, but an interesting livelihood. That there, as we've said on this program before, that human beings will turn out to be the horses of this revolution. You know, steam engines and locomotives and tractors, you know, with the end of the horses run up for glory. Artificial intelligence, thinking machines can do so many things faster, more accurately than we can. Is there not a real risk to us, starting with our livelihoods? Ben?
Well, I think one of the observations we could maybe draw from the Luddite experience is that technology typically doesn't eliminate work exactly. It moves it around, right? It's not that automation, for instance, is eliminating work as a whole. It typically creates different kinds of jobs, often de-skilled jobs, jobs that require less training. So I think that's important to keep in mind in the current conversation around AI. I think it's often kind of a term that's used somewhat recklessly in the media to mean, oh, we're going to move into a world where robots do all the jobs. I think it's much more plausible to move to a near future where you still have a job, but it's much worse and you receive a much lower wage and you endure these kind of very precarious working conditions. And the automation takes care of much of what your job used to do, but you're still there in some capacity. If you've seen the kiosks in McDonald's where you are kind of self-ordering, right? Astra Taylor has a wonderful piece in a recent issue of Logic magazine where she observes this setting and sees that there are still workers in these quote-unquote automated McDonald's, but they're standing next to the kiosks helping you use the kiosk to order your meal. So once again, the workers don't disappear. They just get moved around into different roles typically.
And as any of us who spent time on the phone with a robot trying to access, you know, our healthcare or information about a flight or anything knows, that work can also be pushed onto the consumer. So it's either pushed onto lower paid workers or onto people who are not seen to be doing work in this case at all.
I want to both agree with you and offer a maybe an optimistic counterpoint. And it's the story of hackers. You know, back in the day, so this is late 70s, early 80s, there were centralized computers at MIT, and there were graduate students and professors whose job it was to run the machines and run what were thought to be important experiments on the machines. And there were then a second category of worker who were employed by the university whose job it was to tend the machines. And ironically, the people who were tending the machines, who were completely off the status ladder at the point, would go on to be people like Richard Stallman, and who would invent incredibly innovative ways to use computers for creative ends that the graduate students and the faculty had never thought of. And so I've begun to think a little bit about these sort of interstitial workers who are exactly as you guys describe, next to the machines, and I wonder what they might be able to do. I'm broadly pessimistic, but I do think that Ben's exactly right, that new machines move work around, and we might see a new kinds of workers emerge alongside these new systems.
Hmm. I'm stuck with a bias, I think, that there's a tremendous boon here to information of all kinds, to medical research, for example, in digital technology. But there's something in it that is fundamentally contra-human. And all the things we most like. Also, it's linked to so many of the things that trouble us more and more in this society. Inequality, certain disrespect by class, commercialization. And it's striking to me that so much gets commercialized instantly and relentlessly. But also this advanced alienation that we're all worried about. Then they have to give digitization credit for an alternative to smoky industries when we need to save the atmosphere. But contra-human, I'll stick with that. Contra things that I love doing, including just plain. Well, of course, it's been good for music distribution, but I don't know, how about participation in music, the time that music takes to learn and enjoy together. I don't know.
Yeah, this is Fred. I want to just be sure that we don't over-assign our alienation to the machines and under-assign it to the institutions that regulate our engagement with the machines. You know, surveillance is one thing when I'm talking to my mother-in-law using FaceTime and I'm, in a sense, surveilling her so as I can chat with her. And it's quite another when the National Security Administration or the NSA is monitoring my race and ethnicity to see whether I can fly or not. And I want to be sure that when we start breaking the machines, we break the machines in some settings and not others. I think of the Google workers who refused to, you know, work on military systems recently. I thought that was a terrific example of how we might break some machines. But I'm not convinced that the machines themselves are necessarily dehumanizing, at least not every time.
I'm talking about the culture, of course. Moira, what do you love about the digital age?
Oh, so many things. I mean, my entire life is, I don't know how to think my life apart from the digital age. So all the things I love are in some ways braided into the digital age. But I was actually hoping Ben would speak a bit to the Google worker organizing, since it's something he's been covering in an ongoing way.
Yeah, you have.
Yeah, I think, you know, echoing Fred, I think that's a great example of this Luddite option, so to speak, that there are certain situations where we actually have to say no. And in that case, something called Project Maven, which is an ongoing Pentagon effort to use machine learning to improve the targeting of drone strikes. And you had a very impressive mobilization by Google workers who successfully got the company to agree not to renew that contract, which is a huge, huge win and is, of course, part of an ongoing series of mobilizations by tech workers in the industry, which has been really inspiring to see.
Yeah, and I think it's been especially inspiring because they've begun to imagine themselves and see themselves properly as workers. You know, something I see here in Silicon Valley all the time is the depiction of computer coders and engineers as artists, as creatives, as entrepreneurs, as something other than workers. And I think one of the things that we need to do is recognize that they're workers. And as workers, they should take some of the actions that workers have traditionally taken in other industrial eras.
I want to know what Ben and Moira make of Fred's general argument about the tilt toward authoritarianism, including the alienation of labor around the world in France suddenly in a big way, in this country, in the anger that came to Brexit. What are the connections here? Moira.
Well, I think we're certainly seeing many symptoms of what you might call a tilt towards authoritarianism. There clearly is a kind of crisis of capitalism, crisis of our political systems that's being exacerbated by these technologies all over the world, you know, whether it's the killing of the Rohingya in Myanmar or, you know, the use of WhatsApp to spread disinformation in the election in Brazil or interference in our own election or our tweeting president. We're seeing these kinds of effects worldwide. At the same time, we are seeing new kinds of left mobilizations, new kinds of organizing and resistance on the same platforms. You know, Facebook played a huge role in the teacher strikes, for instance, which I know you covered some time ago. Social media have played a big part in the revival of a socialist left in the United States. So I think that, again, I come down on this answer of ambivalence, but there are certainly very troubling tendencies toward authoritarianism, both online and, you know, IRL in our political institutions.
How ironic, though, to just remember the Arab Spring, Egypt in 2011, and the thought that this was a Facebook or a somehow connected to a Google hopeful conscious moment. I mean, it had a tragic end, and it didn't probably have much to do with Facebook in the end. Ben, what are you loving in prospect in this digitizing moment?
Well, again, I mean, with the caveat, as we've been saying, that all of these liberatory possibilities also have a dark side, have certainly negative qualities as well. I think just picking up on what Moira said about how social media in particular has allowed formerly fringe ideas to find an audience, I think for a new alternative public sphere to be incubated, new political identities.
Small magazines included.
Absolutely. Small magazines
donate
are...
Donate before the end of 2018.
That's right. Donate to your favorite small magazine this year.
It's called Logic.
And let's say thank you on behalf of the podcasters, too, to the enabling of individual voices that has all come out of this technology. Fred, do you want to give us your scorecard?
Yeah, so here I'm going to be a little bit skeptical. I am on the one hand thrilled by the re-empowering of individual voices, and I think that's exactly right. And I love Logic, and I want to encourage people to contribute. I've been a subscriber from the start. I want everyone to subscribe. It's fabulous.
Amen.
But I also think that the turn to individualism has opened up a door onto a kind of politics of the id that we don't really yet know how to deal with, you know, in which, yes, we can express all of ourselves, every part of ourselves, in a very visible, very public way. But when we start to do that, we bump into others who disagree with us. We bump into parts of ourself that may be horrifying. We begin to understand human beings as potentially the kind of rabble that people feared at the end of the 19th century. And that they came to organize in the middle of the 20th in ways that we now recognize as totalitarian. I fear enormously when I see folks in Hungary or elsewhere expressing themselves as kind of experiential leaders. My kind of people believe this. My kind of people say this. My experience tells me this. That logic, which also is the logic that lets people bind themselves together online in new and small and interesting groups, that logic is the logic of fascism, and I don't know what to do with that fact.
I'm still trying to imagine the charismatic but reasonable, rational, centrist leftist who can seize this machinery and use it well. You know, Beto O'Rourke had a great moment of glory there. He didn't win his race, but that probably shouldn't be held against him. But I'm still trying to imagine the real counter to everything that Donald Trump has harnessed. Can you imagine it, Fred?
I can imagine it. It looks different than you might think it does. I actually think back of the Obama campaigns, the last two Obama campaigns. There's a wonderful scholar at the University of North Carolina named Daniel Kreese, and he's written two books on the campaigns, and he's shown that Obama used Obama and affiliated other network groups used digital technologies to create large databases of voters that you might think of as a kind of highly centralized database for controlling voters, but that in fact allowed him to get out the vote and to diversify the participation in the election. What I liked about that story was not only the use of digital media for liberal ends, but the way in which Obama was using digital media to amplify the democratic possibilities of our existing institutions.
Well said, and thank you, Fred Turner. Thank you, Maura Weigel and Ben Tarnov. Fred Turner's cover story for Harper's Magazine is called Machine Politics, The Rise of the Internet, and a New Age of Authoritarianism. It'll be online next week. Our show this week was produced by Super Techies All, Connor Gillies, Rebecca Panovka, the artist Susan Coyne, and engineers George Hicks and Matt Lissette. Miranda Arakelian was a help too. Mary McGrath is the ghost in our machine. I'm Christopher Lydon. That is The Machine. Join us next time on Open Source.